Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and welcome to Perek Dalet of Sefer Melachim, Chapter 4 of the Book of Kings. Continuing from yesterday's story, we noted that the first pasuk of what we call Perek Dalet actually belongs in the traditional division of the text to the prior section, and that's the Rashi and Radak understand it as well. Vayamelech Shlomo Melech HaKol Yisrael, and he was king over the entire Jewish people. So first, Rashi and Radak both point out that it's because of his actions in the previous parak, his ability to judge properly and appropriately and fairly among these two women with the child who had been deceased, that catapulted him into a position where the entire Jewish people were now pleased to have him as their king. Shlomo HaMelech also points out that, Radak also points out that Shlomo HaMelech has an advantage over his father David, in that David did not rule over the entire Jewish people at the beginning. He had to slowly work his way up to it. He had to get rid of enemies. He had to beat back rebellions. Shlomo HaMelech starts at a much higher point, at a pinnacle, whereas David HaMelech did not. There's a Hasidic story about that. It's a short parak today, so I will allow myself to tell it about, I forget which dynasty it is. I think it might be Ger, but in one particular dynasty, the then Rebbe's son had already passed away, and the grandson, who that then Rebbe had raised, was going to become the Rebbe. But the grandson was only like 16 years old when the grandfather was ill with what would be his final illness. And the grandson is speaking to his grandfather and says how he is nervous and uncertain and insecure about his readiness for this task. After all, his grandfather lived a whole life, or much of a life, before he became the Rebbe. And here the grandson is going to be asked to lead at a much younger age. So the grandfather tells him a story to suggest that he was in fact fit. And the story is of a certain mountain, which was rumored to have at the top tremendously wonderful things, but the only way to get up there was to climb it. This was obviously the time before helicopters and airplanes and things like that. And climbing the mountain was a treacherous task and a treacherous undertaking. And one man tries to do it, and it takes him a long time. And he climbs, and he almost falls, and he's hard, and he this, and he comes back, and he goes back, and he eventually gets to the top, and he's at the top, exhausted from, spent from his trip up, and lying there gasping, and trying to recover himself, and a little boy, 4 or 5 years old, comes up to him and says, "Are you all right? Can I help you? What's going on?" The man just looks at him, and he says, "You want to tell me that you climbed up at your age?" And the boy says, "Oh no, I was born up here." So too, I think it's a Gera Rebbe, whoever it was, says to his grandson, "You're ready because you were born in a different situation than I was born." So here too, Shlomo, we're being shown, is born to certain different circumstances than his father David, and takes on the kingship with different circumstances than his father David. So this parak mostly lists to us Shlomo's cabinet, as it were, his people, but it shows us something about a structure of government that will become, again, emblematic and thematic in later chapters. So Isaiahu is the Kohen. The Radak has a problem with this, but the names, it's not the kind of a problem I enjoy delving into, whether it was really Isaiah ben Tzadok, or whether it was Achituv ben Tzadok, whoever it was. So he has this man being a Kohen, exactly what it means by a Kohen, because in Pasuk Dalet will be other Kohanim. So we'll get there. Eli Choref v'Achia b'nei Shisha Sofrim. There were the two guys, Eli Choref and Achia, with the sons of Shisha, they were Sofrim. Yoshafat ben Achilud, Hamazkir. Yoshafat, the son of Chilud, was the Mazkir. So Rashi points out that Sofrim in those days were people who were official court reporters. Their job was to write the court history, to record what had happened. And it's an interesting thing that the awareness of the needs of history, the importance of history, is something that's already at this stage. We will see throughout the book of Melachim, as each king passes away, the book Melachim will mention that the rest of the details about this king's life are recorded in the books of the histories of the kings of Judah, the kings of Israel, in Shlomo Melech's case, in the books of Shlomo, showing something that I've referred to before, that Melachim is not conceiving of itself as a history of these kings. Melachim is telling us specific aspects and incidents of different kings' lives to make points or to highlight points that it thinks of as important. Interesting story about this Eli Choref and Achia, the two sons of Shisha. The Gemara in Sukkah Nun Gimel Amud Aleph. So it's a very interesting story. Tells the story that, and it's to make a point that people's legs, people's instincts, lead them to where they're supposed to be anyway. story goes that Shlomo HaMelech encounters the Malach HaMavet, the angel of death, one day, and he sees that he's sad. And he says, why are you sad? He says, because I need to find a Lichor for Achia, and I can't find them. I'm supposed to kill them, and I can't find them. Shlomo comes home, and he sends a Lichor for Achia away to the area of Luz, and they run away to Luz, and they die there. And then the next day, he sees Malach HaMavet, and was all happy. He says, you know, I had to kill him in Luz. I didn't know how they were going to get to Luz, and then you did it for me. So the Gemara uses that story to make the point that people end up where they're supposed to end up. I'm particularly struck by that story, first of all, because it's almost the exact same as a story that opens up a famous John O'Hare novel. I didn't read the novel, but the story is called Appointment in Samarra. It's told from an Arabic point of view. The same kind of idea, a master and a slave, and he sees death. And death says, I'm looking for your servant. So he sends the servant away to Samarra on the fastest horse. And it turns out that the appointment was in Samarra. So first of all, it's interesting because at least the question of who made up the story. It could be, I mean, this is the Gemara we're talking about. So it could be the Gemara is written down or is recorded in the 500s and written down later. So it's possible that by that time there already was this Arabic version and we took the story from them. Or it's an ancient story, or it's our story that they took from us. But altogether, it's a story that's interesting that makes the interesting point that we are not completely able to fight our fates. We believe in Bechira Chofshi, we believe in free will for sure, yet the story suggests that there are distinct limits on that. Of course, we know the famous Gemara that says, Kol Midei Shemayim, Chutz Mirat Shemayim. That's a Gemara that suggests that we have extremely limited free will, except in areas that have to do with our fear of God. The Rambam, however, in explaining that idea, says that it's not true, that almost anything we do can be an issue of fear of God. So who we marry, for example, the Rambam uses this specific example, since marrying somebody is a mitzvah, and having children with them is a mitzvah, that all has to do with Yirat Shamayim, and therefore we have great free will. So the question of free will comes into play here, and this is a story that highlights it. I noticed it particularly because my father, Alav HaShalom, was very fond of the story, was very fond of the idea of the inescapability of certain kinds of fate. The case of Pasuk Dalid. Uvenayahu ben Yehoyada al Hatzava. Mitzadok Evitar Kwadi. So Benayahu becomes the chief of staff. We've seen Benayahu before. We know Benayahu. We know why he's the chief of staff. And Tzadok and Evitar served his Kohanim. Radak points out this can't be, or we would assume this is not the Evitar that Shlomo had sent away to Anatot, because Shlomo said, you're not going to be a Kohen. So presumably it's a different Evitar, highlighting for us always the question of when you see a name in Tanakh, are you supposed to think it's the same person or a different person? I remember my Rebbe from Gush, Rav Ezra Bick, once pointing out that Chazal seemed to like to minimize the number of characters that were in Tanakh. So they would often identify one person as another person, etc. In this case, they do not do that, so it's not relevant in those terms. But it is relevant to the question of when you read Tanakh and you see names, to what extent should we think that people with the same names are the same person or are different people? Pasuk Hei, Vazayahu ben Natan al Hanitzavim. Yazayahu ben Natan was al hanitzavim. So we're going to see the nitzivim in a second. He was apparently the head of the officers. We're going to see the nitzivim in a second, but he was the head of them. And Zavud was like a private minister of some sort. Kohen re'eh ha-melech, a friend of the king, and a position like that. Achishar al ha-bayit, v'adoniram ben avda al ha-mas. And Achishar was the chief of staff of the household, running a palace, running a king's household takes doing. So he was the head of that. And Adoniram was in charge of the mas. So mas and taxes are going to be an important aspect of Shlomo HaMelech's life. After Shlomo dies, we'll see that the tax issue was a burning one, because the Jews were unhappy about the taxation they experienced in Shlomo's times. So as we watch taxation and see it, we have to keep in mind that Shlomo HaMelech was sort of pushing the point, and it wasn't clear that he did it in the most productive way. It lasted throughout his kingdom, but then becomes the sticking point that will eventually split his kingdom. In the case of the Nitzavim, the next pasuk then points out, the Shlomo, 12 Nitzavim al Kol Yisrael, he had 12 officers who were in charge of the Jewish people. And the way they were in charge was, v'chilkelu et ha-melech v'et beito, they had to support the king and his household. Chodesh b'shana yiyeh ha'echad lechalkel. He had to provide the sustenance for the household for 1 month a year. In other words, not him himself. He had charge over an area of the country. Presumably they were split up about 1/12 and 1/12 for each, and they had to support the king a month a year, which is an interesting way of structuring your government. Meaning Rashi points out that it is the responsibility of the people to pay the king's finances. That's part of the way government works. We pay taxes to have our government support protections and all those what they are. In our time, the way we do it is the central government collects from everybody and then apportions it as it will. Here, the apportioning or the collecting was formed out of these 12 nitzavim, and they had to therefore come across with 1 month's worth. So it was not as fungible as it is in our days. In our days, if, let's say, California falls behind on tax collection, it's a problem for the federal government, but not in any particular month. So it's a general problem. The coffers of the federal government will not be have as much as they were supposed to. Here it would seem that month by month, the question of what kind of support the king and the palace had was dependent on these nitzavim, the single of which is nitziv. Interestingly, the Gemara in Sanhedrin on Yibet Amud Aleph says that nitziv means a yerach, means a moon. And they were called nitzavim or nitzivim because they had to cover 1 moon month a year. And that was their job. So these are who they were, Ve'elash Motam, Ben Chur, Bahar Ephraim, Ben Deker, Ben Makatz, Uvishalvim, Uveit Shamesh, Ve'elon, Ve'et Chanan, each of these people in those various places, again, worth pointing out, place called Shalvim already, place called Beit Shemesh already, so Baruch Hashem that we live in a time when we see these places rebuilt. I don't know if they're the exact places, but certainly that we are returning to a time when we have our traditional places back as a thing to celebrate every time we notice it. Ben Chesed, Ba'an Rabot, Lo Socho v'chol Eretz Chefer. So Ben Chesed had Arubot, and that included Socho in all of the area of Chefer. Ben Avinadav called Nafat Dor, Tafat Bat Shlomo, Etel Elisha, and Ben Avinadav is a Netziv, and not only that, he marries one of the daughters of Shlomo. Ba'na Ben Achilut, Tanach u'Migido, this guy has Tanach u'Migido, v'chol Beit She'an, Asher Etel Sartana, Mitachal Yisrael, Beit She'an, Ad Avel Mecholah, Ad Me'ever Liyok Me'am. Says all these places, all this region was under him. Ben Gever, Miramot Gilad, Lo Chavot Yair, Ben Minashe, Hashem Gilad, so he is in charge of Ramot Gilad, which includes Chavot Yair, the son of Minashe. Those who remember their Chumash will know that when the Jews begin to conquer Eretz, Sichon, and Og, so the tribes of Reuven and Gad come to Moshe and they say, we want to stay here. And Chatzi Menashe joins them. So that's Yair ben Menashe goes and he conquers certain cities and they call them Chavot Yair after him. So Lo Chemel Agomashem Bashan, Shishim Arim Gidalot, Chomal Vriach, the Choshen. And that area included 60 cities. Kol Chemel Argov is what it says in the Torah about it. All of this plains of Argov, the region of Argov. And there were 60 cities there. And they were a great city. They had walls and they had bars and gates and well protected. Achinadab ben Ido Machanayma. So he had Machanayim. Achimatz ben Naphtali. Kamula Kachar Bas Papa Yishpon Lisha. He also married a daughter of Shlomo. So if you wanted to marry into the king's family, one of the good ways was to become a netziv, become a head of a region and pay the taxes that would keep the palace going that month. Banabat ben Chushai Be'asher Uve Alot. Yoshevat ben Paroch b'Yisachar, Shimon ben Eleah b'Binyamin, Gever ben Uri b'Eretz Gilad, just all these people in these lands, Shimon ben Eleah b'Binyamin, Gever ben Uri in the land of Gilad, Eretz Yichon, Melech HaAmori, V'yog Melech Meshan, Ritziv Echad, Hashem Ha'aretz. There's one Nitziv that was in the land. So it's not clear what in the land means. It may mean that he was in charge of all of them, or he was a minister without portfolio, or some such thing. But that's the Nitzivim system. So the last pasuk of the Perek, though, going to be one that we can do something with, as the Gemara does something with it three different times, and we'll get to that in a second, but just notice, Shlomo HaMelech's, the largest amount of time spent in this parak in explaining the finances of the kingship and how the king kept himself in strong finances, and these 12 Nitzivim, and their names, and their regions of the division. This is not a formality, this is a formality of financial management that was not true of, and not available to David HaMelech, and is worth noticing. Yeah. So Pasuk Chaf says, Yudav Yisrael Rabim Kachol Asher Alayam Larov Ochlim V'Shotim Usmechim. The Yudav Yisrael, the tribe of Yudah and the Jewish people, are multitudinous as the sand on the shores of the sea, that's so many of them, and they eat, and they drink, and they're happy. So that, the summation of it, says something important to us in terms of the taxation. Meaning I've pointed out yesterday and today, and we'll see it other times, that Shlomo HaMelech's kingship is one that is dominated by excess. Yet it's worth noting that excess isn't always bad. While it's true that after Shlomo passes from the scene, the people complain about the taxes and they want relief from the taxes, this pasuk at least would seem to suggest that even with a heavy tax burden, and even with Shlomo HaMelech doing things with his heavy tax burden, it was still true that things are going well. In boom times, everybody's doing well, even if they're paying a lot in taxes. So that's what the summation of Shlomo HaMelech's life seems to be, that at least for the vast majority of his rule, of those 40 years, it was boom times. Lots of taxes, lots of expenses, lots of, you know, lavishness in the central government, and presumably it trickled down to elsewhere. With all of that lavishness, people were able to do fine and do well and be happy. That's always a question in terms of finances, how we handle our finances. When is excess too much? When is it not? In this case, it seems the boom was going on at least during Shlomo's time, that it was fine. I have noted that it's an issue in my mind because certainly when the boom ends, so the question becomes how to handle it. As the boom ends towards the end of Shlomo's life and leads into Rechavam's life, it fosters eventually the split that characterizes the Jewish people for the rest of their history, and that seems like a very negative consequence. So the awareness of boom times and their challenges and dangers is one worth pointing out. In terms of this last pasuk of the parak, and it's a very short parak, it's only 20 psukim, and besides that, most of the psukim are just names of people and the tasks that they fulfilled. But this particular pasuk has three different discussions of it in the Gemara that are interesting. Gemara in Zvachim notes that when the Jews came back from Bavel for the second temple, they added to the dimensions of the Mizbeach, of the altar. They added to the dimensions of the altar because the altar as it was could not handle the traffic of sacrifices that there were in the second temple. And the Gemara doesn't understand that. The Gemara says, I don't understand. It doesn't say it in those words, but the Gemara says, in the time of Shlomo HaMelech, the altar handled it. And that was when the pasuk, our pasuk characterizes there as having been the Jewish people multitudinous as the sands of the sea. And yet, their sacrifices were sustained by the altar. And when only 41,000 people, 42,000 people come back, the small numbers, 41,000 people come back, the altar wasn't enough. So the Gemara gives an answer, and it's a question of whether you think that's a sufficient answer or not. The Gemara's answer is that at the time of Shlomo HaMelech, the fire on the altar of the Beit HaMikdash was a fire that came down from heaven. Right? We have this in the Chumash, that when the Jews are building the Mishkan, they look for the fire to come down to heaven to start it, and that fire is maintained, and then they keep the fire going, and it stays throughout Jewish history, at least until the end of Bayit Rishon. So the Gemara seems to be saying that, indeed, there were many more sacrifices in the time of Shlomo HaMelech, but they were sustainable. We were able to handle the traffic of sacrifices because Hashem's fire burns faster or better or stronger than the fire of the time of Ezra, the time of Bayit Sheni. So you can take that at face value and just assume that's true. That already means, though, that laws of nature as we know them in the Gemara's mind are not absolute laws of nature. Fire doesn't burn as it burns. There's fire from God, and that burns in one way, and there's regular fire that burns another way. That's one issue or one possibility. I also wonder, though, as I think about it, whether it's not possibly true that in the time of Bayit Rishon, when people had Bamot, and we see it throughout, almost throughout Bayit Rishon, and by the time they maybe give up on Bamot, they have idol worship, there may have been in fact less traffic to the Beit HaMikdash than there was in Bayit Sheni, because in Bayit Sheni, they all already knew over the sacrifice and the Beit HaMikdash. So it at least seems to be at least another possibility to suggest that in fact, even though there were only 41,000 time in Bayit Sheni, and there were Kechol Asher Alayam, Larov here, the actual sacrifice of the Beit HaMikdash itself or somewhat less. Of course, Shlomo Melech takes up a lot of that traffic on his own because he gives like 1,000 olot a day in some traditions of Shlomo Melech. We'll see it later on. So it's possible that you need the Gemara's answer as well. Another issue to think about is the Gemara in Bava Metzia on Pei Vav Amid Bet tells an interesting story about Rabbi Yochanan ben Matya, who sent his son to hire some workers. And as part of the deal, when they were making the son agrees that they will feed them, the workers, while they're working. Meaning, you know, there are jobs where you get lunch, and jobs where you don't get lunch. So this is a job where you're supposed to get lunch. So he comes over, he tells his father this. And he tells his father this, and the father says that you've gotten us into trouble. Because even if you give them a seuna like Shlomo, it's not good enough. So Shlomo, we're going to see in Parakeh, has lots and lots of meals every day, another example of excess that we'll get to in Parakeh. But in Parakeh, the Pasuk says that his food for one day was a huge amount of food. Thirty cores of flour and 60 cores of regular flour, and 10 cattle that were healthy and 20 cattle that were just coming from pasture, and 100 sheep, aside from deers and gazelles and fallow deer and geese. Lots and lots of food being eaten every day. And he said that's not going to be enough for these people. Why not? Because they are the descendants of Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov, and Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov had greater meals. So the Gemara says, what do you mean they had greater meals? Avraham, we see, when he wants to feed the angels, he takes Ben Bakar, he takes a young ox, Rach, they think is the second one, and Tov and Good is the third one, and it's three. So the Gemara says, yes. That was three oxen being slaughtered for three people. And that apparently was the standard of Avraham's time, or Avraham's meals, was to eat, to kill a whole ox for each of them. So therefore, you're in trouble with these people because you have to kill every day, apparently, or every day they're working for you, a whole ox. So it's interesting, Gemara, because Gemara suggests that for all that we see excess in Shlomo HaMelech's time, we shouldn't think that that was the most excess you could imagine. You could even be more excessive than that. And in Avraham's time, they're even more excessive than that. The questions of waste and issues like that, I think, are important questions that are a question for today, but questions that come up in that story. And also instructive in terms of how we take this. Eating and drinking, and there's a lot of it going on, but that was the most possible? That's a question for the Gemara. It's also plausible to say that even though Avraham kills three oxen, they didn't eat that much of the oxen, but then the only challenge for Rabbi Yochanan ben Matya's son was that he would be required to show them such a mass amount of food that they were not able to afford. That was the problem. One final issue in the story is another Gemara above Metzia that's talking about the question of when we do or don't ask for rain. The Gemara there has a braita which says that already the third of Macheshvan you would ask for rain, and Rav Gamliel says on the seventh. And our tradition is that it's 15 days after the Chag, so the last person among the Jewish people could get all the way to Nahar Prat, which is as far as they came from for Regel, for Sukkot.
And that tradition about the rain issue and it being 15 days away and people having to go 15 days back to where they were is a problem, because there's a Mishnah. In the Mishnah there, Rabbi Yehuda claims that you'd have to wait. In order, if you find an object and you want to keep it as your own, you're required to announce it in the Beit in Yerushalayim, where people came for the regalim. That would be like a central place. And Rabbi Yehuda says you have to do it for three regalim. After the three regalim, you have to wait 7 more days, and then you could start using it and assume that it was just hefker, it's lost, we don't know who the owners are, and therefore you can have it. So why 7 days? So he says 3 days to go home, a day at home to check out what was going on, see that he, in fact, himself had lost it, and then 3 days back, or the other way around. 3 days to go home, 3 days to come back, and 1 day to declare it lost and declare it found and to look for it. So the Gemara says, I don't understand. I thought it was 15 days, because that's when we were waiting for the rain. Where it says, that was in the times of Bayit Rishon. Times of Bayit Rishon, there were massive numbers of Jews, and that's why you have to wait 15 days. But later on, at the times of Bayit Sheni, you didn't have to wait so much to declare lost items because it was only 3 days. Now, so the Gemara is taking that in terms of the numbers of Jews that are out there. Again, one could theoretically say that it's a question of how far people came from, and you could even reverse it theoretically. You could have said, in Bayit Rishon, people came mostly from around Yerushalayim, a 3-day travel. Whereas in Bayit Sheni, their connection to Beit HaMikdash was stronger, and they came from further. The Gemara doesn't take it that way. The Gemara assumes that in Bayit Rishon, they came from far away. There were so many Jews, and they were so spread out, which again says, or worth noticing, says not again, worth noticing, says that the Jews weren't only living in Eretz Yisrael. There were so many of them, they'd already spread out to 15 days travel away from the Beit HaMikdash, and they used to come to the Beit HaMikdash for Regalim. Whereas in Bayit Sheni, there were fewer Jews in Israel and fewer Jews spread out who were coming to the Beit HaMikdash, and therefore, as long as you gave them 3 days travel time, that was pretty much the maximum for which people came, which says that in Bayit Sheni, apparently, there was less of a connection to the Beit HaMikdash and fewer Jews in general than there were in Bayit Rishon. Connection to the Beit HaMikdash is, of course, a mixed bag, as we'll see throughout the book of Malachim and the book of Yeshayahu, but there you have it, and there it is. I'm Gideon Rothstein. This has been Perek Dalet of Sefer Melachim. Have a good day.